is Monday, September the 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, are we seeing a pullback in the refugee crisis in Europe?
We certainly are, and it's interesting that the response is to build more fences and barriers.
Also ahead, making South Sudan's peace deal work, plus profiling the Ban Perry. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Germany has temporarily suspended participation in the European Union system of passport-free movement between member countries and has imposed border controls, saying it was forced to do so to limit the influx of refugees from war-torn countries, mainly Syria and Iraq. The announcement on Sunday came on another fast-moving day in Europe's migration crisis, with Germany halting all the trains for 12 hours with its neighbor Austria, the main conduit through which 450,000 refugees have arrived in Germany this year. International Edition's Victor Beatty asked Monash University EU politics scholar Ben Wellings, could Germany have anticipated it might face issues with a large influx of refugees?
Yes and no. I think, you know, we might expect a country to close its borders if there was an unprecedented migration from outside inwards. On the other hand, Germany's borders are regulated by something called the Schengen Treaty, and this is a treaty from 1995 that essentially provides, you know, the borderless Europe that we know. So for the Germans to close their borders actually really imperils this fundamental treaty of European integration. And that's why this is, in one level, a surprise. And on the other hand, you know, dealing with hundreds of thousands of migrants, we might expect governments to try and seek to control this flow of people in some way.
There appears to be no illegality involved. Apparently, a country within the EU and a signatory to the Schengen Treaty can do this on a temporary basis.
On a temporary basis, but it does go against the spirit of the Schengen Treaty and one of the kind of fundamental principles of European Union, which is the free movement of labour. But, of course, the intention of the designers of this treaty was for Europeans to move around within Europe, you know, without borders inhibiting them and the movement of goods and services and capital as well. It was never really designed with such an unprecedented migration crisis in mind. And I think that, you know, there's always a tension in Europe between, you know, the kind of the European spirit, but then, of course, the fact that governments are in control of nation states. Nation states are still important actors, even in Europe, and probably becoming more so. So there's very much a kind of a conflict here, if you like, for the spirit animating European integration.
Ben, there's the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic said his country is boosting its police presence along the Austrian-Czech border. Hungarian authorities are about to fortify their southern frontier. Are we seeing a pushback to this crisis?
We certainly are, and it's interesting that the response is to build more fences and barriers. I mean, in you know, to someone who grew up in the Cold War, this is quite evocative, the notion of barbed wire barriers between different nation states, and particularly those within Europe, where for 20 years, you know, the story has been about bringing down barriers. Then this is definitely a pushback. The other dimension to this, of course, is the religious or racial dimension. You know, the extent to which will Christian minorities be more welcome than Muslim refugees, as we see people like Viktor Orban, you know, making that case in Hungary.
Ben, EU officials Monday meet in Brussels to discuss a European Commission plan to allow in 160,000 asylum seekers over 2 years. Is this plan outdated even before it begins to be debated?
Well, I think the German decision, you know, will cast some debate on this. The so-called Visegrad countries, that's Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia and Poland, are kind of welcoming this as an endorsement of their pushback over the past week or so. So I think it suggests It will show the limits of the power of the European Commission vis-a-vis its member states. The question is, you know, to what extent will other countries sign up, those countries without a tradition of receiving migrants, but rather, you know, sending them, like Poland, which they will sign up to resettling people caught up in the Syrian crisis. So it may well, I wouldn't say that it's over before it started, but the European Commission and the interior ministers who are meeting are definitely going to have to be responding to events as they unfold hour by hour.
That's Ben Wellings. He is a European Union politics scholar in residence at Monash University. He's also the author of Nation, Memory, and Great War Commemoration, Mobilizing the Past in Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. Dr. Wellings spoke from Melbourne, Australia, with International Edition's Victor Beattie. Well, as huge numbers of people flee Syria and Iraq for Europe, the United States has announced it will be welcoming several thousand refugees. International Edition's Jim Stevenson asked VOA correspondent Michael Bowman how many refugees from this crisis will be coming to the U.S.
I believe that to date the United States has taken in something on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 Syrian refugees. When you consider that millions of Syrians have been displaced, now not all of them are outside of Syria. There are many who are internally displaced. But nevertheless, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of Syrians who have fled their country. 1,000 to 2,000 is a drop in the bucket in terms of what the United States has taken in. And even with the Obama administration announcing that the United States will take in 10,000 additional Syrian refugees, those who advocate on behalf of refugees say that that is still a drop in the bucket. Mm. It's a slightly larger drop in the bucket, but it really doesn't go far enough. Now we get into an interesting phase in terms of Congress, because today on national television you had the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Representative Michael McCaul, saying, well, of course we want to help, and of course the United States should be helping, but we can't simply allow a large population of people to come in without the proper screening. And he's very concerned that the Islamic State could try to put some of their people as infiltrators within the refugee population. And then, in effect, the United States would be importing Islamic radicals with nefarious intent, to say the least. The White House spokesman Josh Earnest at the briefing on Friday said that there will be security protocols, and while time is of the essence in terms of responding to the refugee crisis, that there will be no corners cut.
I saw a figure online last week that said something on the order of the United States takes in about 70,000 refugees annually from various parts of the world. So the 10,000 figure would represent a pretty good portion of that. But a lot of human rights groups are calling for the United States to go well beyond that.
Indeed. I didn't hear this in any of the Sunday talking points. However, it's my understanding that the United States does provide a significant portion of the aid that is flowing into that region to combat the humanitarian crisis on the ground. Now, money does not equal, is not the sending money and relief supplies and blankets and medicines and food. That's not the same as taking in actual human beings. But I suspect that if one were to look at the totality of what the United States is doing, the United States is very much involved in the coalition that is battling the Islamic State. The United States is providing significant amounts of humanitarian relief. Where the United States does seem to be lagging is in the total number of refugees allowed. Whether this 10,000 is an initial adjustment to sort of see how it goes, and then maybe there will be other groups admitted. I don't know. No one has addressed that point yet. But what we do know is that over the next year to maybe 18 months, there will be a significant boost in the number of Syrians coming in. Does that address the Syrian refugee crisis? No, it doesn't. But the United States is boosting the total number.
That is VOA correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. Now it's time to catch up with International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's here, about what's being said on Twitter about the refugee crisis in Europe. Hello, G.
Hi, Steve. Before we get on to what's being said, let's talk about the hashtags we should look for on Twitter. I went on to Topsy Analytics website to see the hashtags people are using to tweet about the situation in Europe. Hashtag refugee crisis was used 7,000 times, while hashtag migrant crisis was used less than 2,700 times in the last 24 hours. In the same time frame, hashtag Syrian refugees was used in more than 82,000 times. It's quite interesting, hashtag Syrian refugees was used almost 9 times more than both of the other hashtags combined.
Absolutely, G, and it appears that more Twitter users are viewing the situation as a refugee crisis, not a migrant crisis.
Exactly. Steve, as you know, the majority of the people trying to get into the EU are seeking asylum, which makes them refugees and not migrants. They're fleeing from extremely dangerous situations in their home countries, like the civil war in Syria or the terrorist group Islamic State, also known as ISIL.
I see. Before you go, G, tell us about a Twitter account we can follow to keep updated on the refugee crisis.
Sure. The UN Refugee Agency is prolific on Twitter, and its handle is @refugees. Earlier Sunday, the agency tweeted a link to its statement ahead of Monday's EU meeting on refugee crisis. The statement urges the EU to establish a comprehensive response. It elaborated the response must be based on the creation of effective reception centers with the support of all parties concerned, including UNHCR, to properly assist, register, and screen people upon arrival in Greece, Italy, and Hungary. Steve, I'd like to add that pretty soon the EU members could face mandatory quotas to take in 120,000 refugees who already made it to those countries. That's all for me today.
And many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. And you can follow her on Twitter @GAbbyLee. You can also follow International Edition on Twitter @VOA_IE. Still ahead, new schools for Jordan. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter @PerryCal or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. U.S.-based International Relief and Development, IRD, has transferred 8 schools it constructed to Jordan's government as part of a long-term plan to build 28 new schools and renovate 100 additional schools over several years. These state-of-the-art facilities in central and northern Jordan were funded by USAID. That's part of the U.S. State Department. All of this comes at a precarious time for the countries in the Middle East in light of the refugees leaving Iraq and Syria because of the Islamic State insurgency. We're joined now from Amman by IRD's program director in Jordan, Rula Abdulkish Katkuda. Rula, tell us about this project in Jordan.
The Ministry of Education did an assessment to identify locations for prospective schools, for areas where there were no schools. Children either had to make a long commute, and usually it was by walking, or where current conditions had it that they were rented buildings and they were doing double shifts and very overcrowded facilities. So, yes, the majority of these schools were built in areas where there were no facilities for the students to go to, and especially for girls. I mean, out of the eight schools we built, 6 are for girls, which is wonderful, because prior to having these schools in their own communities, girls either got to a certain age and then had no access to formal education.
I know it's no secret that Jordan is in a very volatile part of the world. I know life goes on every day and people try to live and, and succeed there. And the country's well known for being a good neighbor in the area.
Yes, it is.
Just next door is Syria. Now, we don't need to get into the politics of what's happening, but as a result of what is going on in Syria, lots of people have left that country and come into Jordan. Has this put any pressure or any burden on Jordan's school system? Is that a part of why these schools might be needed?
These schools are independent of the political situation around us. These are built based on needs for the Ministry of Education. Now, of course, with an influx of Syrian refugees and, you know, prior to that influx of Iraqi refugees into the country, it put a big strain on the resources of the country in terms of not just in education, housing, water, food, the prices went up and all this. But in within the, for the Iraqis and for the Syrian refugees now, there are other programs in place to try to get them enrolled in the schools and actually to do makeshift schools for these people within their communities.
When I say state-of-the-art, these truly are top-notch, very modern schools, are they not?
Yes, they are.
And so
they have all the amenities that I think we had. We recently had visitors from USAID come and from our own headquarters in the States come, and they all commented that these schools are nicer than the ones that they even went to. The libraries and the labs and the spacious classrooms and the lighting and the playgrounds and computer rooms and community, like on the multipurpose hall where they can have functions and where Samah people and their program do a lot of their community work. There's fully accessible to handicapped people, which until this, these people, persons with handicaps, were completely marginalized. The schools did not have a way, you know, there was no way to get to the schools with lots of stairs and so forth. They had early learning centers. They had child care centers for teachers with mothers who can also put their kids in schools with them. So they are beautiful, beautiful schools. And USAID has done a wonderful job in supporting, bringing education forward in this country, I believe.
Rula Abdu Kichkatkuta is IRD's Jordan School Project Director. Thank you, Rula. She's speaking with us from Amman, Jordan. Also in the news today, suicide bombers killed at least seven people. It happened Sunday in attacks in the northern Cameroonian town of Kolafata. That's a border area that has suffered numerous attacks from Nigerian-based Boko Haram insurgents. Cameroon is a major contributor to an 8,700-man multinational joint task force aimed at defeating the Sunni insurgency. Both sides in the South Sudan conflict plan to attend a special meeting on the conflict and peace agreement implementation in New York on September the 29th on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. The meeting is an invitation by the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon. South Sudanese Foreign Minister Barnaba Mariel Benjamin told VOA that Vice President James Wani Igga will lead the government's delegation.
Really, the international community, especially the United Nations, should really recognize the efforts that the President of the Republic of South Sudan, General Salva Kiir Mayardit, is doing with regards to bringing peace to his country.
He said it should involve positive discussions, not to be about punishment and negativity. Following reports of ongoing fighting, the United States has been among a group of nations warning of sanctions that could last month's peace agreement to an end, the nearly two-year conflict, not be fully implemented. Ambassador Ezekiel Lal Gatkuth, the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the rebels, expressed his hopes that the three items would be discussed.
The world supporting peace in South Sudan, mobilizing the world also to mobilize resources to reconstruct South Sudan, mobilizing the whole world also to help in resettlement of the IDPs and refugees in the neighboring countries and also internally inside the country.
He says that rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar will lead the rebel delegation to the talks. Two sides are engaged in security talks in Ethiopia this week. UN Special Envoy Bernardino León Sunday said Libya's rival governments have reached a consensus on the main elements of a political agreement. Speaking in Morocco, León said the two sides were able to overcome their differences amid aimed at forging a national unity government ahead of the September 20th deadline. Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika on Sunday replaced his intelligence chief, who served in the post for 25 years and was nicknamed the Kingmaker. General Mohamed Medyan, who ran the powerful Department of Intelligence and Security, has been replaced by his deputy, General Afame Tartag. He is seen as the latest move to restructure the DRS and comes after April's re-election of Mr. Bouteflika, who has rarely been seen public after suffering a stroke in 2013. A South African school official bludgeoned to death 25 years ago for refusing to take part in a witchcraft-related ritual was beatified by the Roman Catholic Church on Sunday, moving him a step closer to sainthood. A letter from Pope Francis declared that Benedict Daswa, killed in 1990, will join the ranks of the blessed for his heroic witness to the gospel, even to the shedding of blood. South Africa's deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, congratulated the Daswa family.
This is an occasion in which millions of South Africans will share with deep faith and affection. This is the first time in the history of the Catholic Church of Southern Africa that a South African man is being recognized as a blessed martyr of Christ.
Daswa was killed for refusing to pay a sorcerer who promised to end a series of destructive storms that destroyed several village homes northeast of Johannesburg. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have discovered an incredibly massive and productive galaxy cluster located about 9.8 billion light years from Earth in the Ursa Major constellation. The galaxy cluster is named 1049 plus 56, and one of its most interesting qualities is its ability to produce new stars at an extraordinary rate. Galaxy clusters are parts of the universe where hundreds of galaxies group together and are bound to each other through gravity. The newly discovered galaxy cluster contains at least 27 galaxies and has a total mass equal to about 400 trillion suns. It's producing more than 860 stars per year. By comparison, our own Milky Way galaxy creates only one star each year. The astronomers were able to make the discovery with a combination of observatories. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Grammy winners, the band Perry, with its sibling members Kimberly, Reed, and Neil, has been nominated for a CMA Award in the Vocal Group of the Year category. But their latest single, Live Forever, is more of a pop song than their traditional Newgrass country. International Edition's David Byrd reports that the new sound came from the band's imagination and from working with top producers like Red One and Diplo.
If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn, send me away with the words of a love song.
The band Perry, lead singer Kimberly and her brothers Reed and Neil, is known for its close harmonies, strong lyrics, and its bluegrass roots. Their breakout hit, If I Die Young, is a multi-platinum single and launched the group into country music stardom. But Kimberly Perry and her brothers have departed from that more traditional sound in their new single, Live Forever.
I was dreaming of war, saw that I wouldn't die. Was dreaming of shores that my ship would find.
That new sound is a result of the group's work with Lady Gaga's producer, Red One, who also produced Nicki Minaj's Starship. Kimberly Perry says that Red One's talent for teaming gigantic melodies with powerful lyrics to produce anthem-like songs was just what the band wanted.
That was one reason that we were really excited to work with him because, of course, coming from country music, you know, country's really all about the narrative. So we were interested in putting a really narrative lyric with a gigantic melody that made everybody who heard it really want to sing along with it. And so, you know, we brought our narration into the room and Red One brought Big Melody and Live Forever was born. We're gonna live.
The group also worked with producer Diplo, who has worked with Britney Spears, Shakira, Beyoncé, No Doubt, Justin Bieber, Usher, Snoop Dogg, and Chris Brown. Neil Perry, who plays mandolin in the band, says it was an exciting change for Diplo to record the acoustic-based band.
You know, it is interesting, too, to hear how a guy who wouldn't typically record organic instruments like mandolins,
banjo,
three-part family harmony, see how he would interpret that. And I think it made for some really unique sounds that will make this next album a step up from where Pioneer was. Yeah, we're gonna live.
The band Perry has not named their new album, and they have not announced its release date yet. But Kimberly Perry has said that the group was dreaming in color when they recorded the album, and the video for Live Forever is awash in bright yellow and other neon colors. Kimberly says that brightness and excitement is an indication of the flavor that fans can look for. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Many thanks to you, David, and thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia, long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, has made many strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are now signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with it, the U.S. mission to Somalia began operations on September 8th. It is based within the United States Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and will be headed by a chargé d'affaires until President Obama appoints and the Senate confirms the next U.S. ambassador. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship, since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia on January 13th, as announced by Secretary of State John Kerry on May 5th during his historic visit to Mogadishu. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then-growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, U.S. officials began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.